This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. If you're like me, you're always looking for a great plant to introduce to your garden. Well, today we're going to hear about some winners of the Green Thumb Award. That's an annual competition that recognizes outstanding and innovative new plants and garden products. And with us to tell you about them is Diane Blazek. She's Executive Director of All America Selections and National Garden Bureau. Do you have a favorite plant variety that you just love to use? Well, we want to hear about it. Or maybe you have questions about previous winners. We'd like to hear from you, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Diana. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you
for having me. I said Diana, and it's Diane.
Well, that's true, but you know, I can be called either one. I will answer.
Well, I appreciate that. So, first off, tell us about the two organizations that you're associated with. Let's talk with the National Garden Bureau first.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's a good choice. It's the older organization. We were founded in 1920, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. We just celebrated our 100th anniversary back during COVID year, so unfortunately we weren't able to party or celebrate as much as we wanted, but we're still going strong. It was founded by a gentleman who was a journalist, and he decided the general public needed more and better gardening information. And so that's how it was started, by this gentleman who actually was also involved in the creation of the Victory Gardens. He was very instrumental in that in World War I, but even more so in World War II. And he wrote the original Victory Garden book that was published in 1942.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I did not realize that. So then how did the All-American Selections come along?
So that's interesting also. There was a gentleman from the South. There was something back then called the Southern Seedsmen Association, and his idea was to create a neutral nonprofit organization that would trial new varieties that are coming to the market. And I like to call him a doubting Thomas, because he just wanted to prove that these claims that they were making, you know, this was hybridizing was really coming to be in between the two world wars. So he founded this nonprofit in 1932. And the whole basis is trialing new varieties to see if they're better than something that is already on the market.
Right. I mean, that's important for everybody, businesses as well as the, you know, our personal gardens.
Exactly. Yeah, you want something that is going to thrive and survive, you know, not fail or not be not as good as something else that you've used. So, yeah, that's the whole premise behind the AAS trials.
Sure. And I think we've all seen those old seed catalogs where they've got these humongous tomatoes. And I know my grandfather used to fall for those every year. Couldn't figure out why the tomatoes didn't get big. Right, exactly.
Right, yeah.
Well, the main reason that we wanted to talk with you today is to take a look at the 2025 Green Thumb winners. Tell us about that distinction. How do these varieties get nominated?
So this is something that is newer for us. We've been doing it for 3 years, and then it was around about a decade before with another organization. And so the concept here is not that they're actually trialed in ground, but that they are evaluated by a panel of horticulturists and separately by home gardeners on whether or not they're innovative, you know. Is it just another red petunia, or is it something really cool, a new color or a new feature or a new use or something like that? So that's what the Green Thumb Award is. And we have two divisions. Like I said, the Professional's Choice are voted on by our members. And then the People's Choice, we put it out on social media, and we just ask for the public to vote on it.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool. Which social media platforms are you using for that?
All of them.
You have to kind of do that, don't you?
Yeah. Facebook and Instagram are probably the ones we use primarily. The one that I would say we have the biggest following on, though, is Pinterest, because Pinterest is all about inspiration, you know?
Oh, yes.
So Yeah.
Yes, I'm addicted to that. So many boards, so many things I'll never get to. Right,
right.
So when people just say like, oh, well, I used this or I grew this and it was great. Is that how that works?
No, because these are newer varieties. They probably haven't even made it to the local garden center yet. They're all part of our new varieties and new garden products program. So they have to be new, but yet available to consumers this year. So for instance, you know, if you wanted to go to your local garden center, if that garden center chooses to carry this, they would be available this year. So we don't want to, you know, give this Green Thumb Award too early before it's available, and we don't want to do it too late once the newness wears off. So there's a fine balance.
Sure, that makes sense. But the people who, like the users, the gardeners, People's Choice Awards people, how do they know about these?
So we just put out the information through social media, give a picture, give a description. A lot of times there's a video to go along with explains what is new and different. So they are viewing, watching, listening, and then making their decision. Kind of a hard decision. Like in our annuals category, we had more than 20 different varieties.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was kind of hard for them to choose, but they did, and we ended up with our winners.
Oh, that's great, because that would explain sometimes where there's an overlap where the professionals and the people voted for the same ones.
You're right. Yes, we do have some dual winners.
Okay. Well, let's get to those categories. The first one, let's talk about the annual winners.
Okay. So for the People's Choice, the winner is a Calibrachoa. It's called Lea, capital L, capital I, capital A, Abstract Lemon Cherry. So when we were talking earlier, I said that these have to be innovative and something different. And I'll try to describe this flower because that's what's so different is the flower coloration. It's a nice lemon yellow with a cherry red coloration, and it kind of varies. In some places, it's really an intense solid color red in between every other petal that maybe is yellow. And then in some places, it's more like a paintbrush has brushed on. So that is the color combination that's unique.
It's beautiful. I'm looking at the picture right now because if you also want to follow along, you can go to NGB, which is NationalGardenBureau.org. And if you do / Green Thumb Award winners, it'll pop up and you can see that picture and a description of it. Now, what I really like is that it looks like it'll be perfect for a hanging basket or a container.
Yes, you're right. And that, in general, that's what Calibrachoas are so good for. So, yes, it's shown in a container, and I think that's where it excels.
Okay. And then let's just go to the professional annual.
Okay. Yes. The professional's choice in annuals is a Cosmos, and it's called Seashells Red. And this, again, I'm going to urge people to go to the website because it's hard to define, but these Cosmos have tubular petals. The interior of the petal is a vibrant deep pink, and then the outer is a paler pink. It's called red, but to me, it's more pink than red.
Yeah.
But it is a Cosmos, so it's very easy to grow, will do well, and it has these unique petal shapes.
It is. It's beautiful. And usually Cosmos are seeds, right? Is that how we...
Exactly.
Them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that. The Calibrachoa comes from cuttings. Mm-hmm. So you'll find those as plants in your garden center. This Cosmos, comes as seed. So you'll be able to find it as seed, or some places might have some starts of the Cosmos.
Okay. And of course, if we do annuals, we have to do the perennials. And what do we have for our People's Choice?
So for the People's Choice, it's a Buddleia. So it's a butterfly bush. And this one is called Little Rockstars Red. And what is so unique about this one is how small it is. So maybe you don't want to put it in ground. Maybe you're concerned about the invasiveness. You know, there's a couple states that have it on their watch list.
Oh, I did not realize that. And really, it is red, but it's called red, but it's really... purple, right?
I think it's a purpley red. Yes.
Who's naming these, Diane? I'm wondering.
Names, but, you know, you go with the creative aspect.
Right, I guess. So, but if anybody's ever had like a butterfly bush, in many cases, they flap. And so this one doesn't look like it will.
Exactly, because it's so compact and it's very highly branching. So it's got more branches, but yet it's not going to put on these huge flower heads that will cause it to flop over.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Do you know how tall it gets? Because it didn't have it under description that I'm looking
at. It's less than 2 feet tall.
Oh, yeah, perfect. So again, so great
very
for
compact,
small pot.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. And then with the professionals?
So this one, I love this. You know, I don't think hellebores get enough attention in the garden.
Agreed.
Or in the garden center or in the media. So hellebores are really cool. They're one of the first things that are going to bloom in the spring. This one is called JWLS Endless. Now, JWLS is just a series name. So the main thing you want to know is endless. And to describe it, it is white. You know, a lot of them have kind of these purple or rose-colored colorations. So this one's all white with a little hint, tinge of green. But what's really cool is that it's going to bloom longer, and those flower heads will be a little bit more upright. You know, the famous
yes.
thing about hellebores is how you put the mirror under because
yes.
they droop. They look down instead of up. So this one will be a little bit more upward facing and will bloom for a longer time.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we don't give as much love to hellebores as we should, is that they just aren't as showy because the flowers are facing down.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now try the new endless and you'll get a little bit of a variation there.
Yeah, try a hellebore. Now, I don't usually see those in the gardens places, the greenhouses, big box stores for sure. Do you think that's because they are such an early bloomer that by the time they would be out in the garden center, they're almost done?
I think so. I think, you know, overall gardening is kind of a short time frame in a lot of people's mind. You can do stuff year round. You can do early spring, you can do late fall, but until you have more experience, I think you don't realize, oh my goodness, yes, I could have this early spring garden, I could have a spring garden, I can have a summer garden, I can have a late summer garden. There's different things that bloom throughout that time, you know, especially when it comes to perennials or blooming shrubs.
Right.
An annual, yeah, you'll get out there after your last frost date and you'll plant them and they'll last until the first frost. But that's the same old, and that's wonderful. But for some variety, try some perennials that are going to bloom at different times.
Yes, yes. And especially in the spring, because there's nothing like that first bloom to know that spring is coming, no matter what the weather is like.
That puts a smile on your face, right?
For sure. We're talking to Diane Blazek. She is Executive Director of All America Selections and the National Garden Bureau. Do you have any questions for us? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Make sure that you stay with us because coming up at 2:15, our friend Joel Karsten, the father of straw bale gardening, is going to be back with us. And that's always fun to talk to him. Right now, of course, we are talking about the Green Thumb Award winners. And Diane, I think we're probably up to what, edibles at this point? What was the people's choice?
Yeah. So there's two different ones, the People's Choice one and then the Professional's Choice. And they're not the same one, which we'll get to one or two here.
Right, yeah.
One on both sides. But here's what's interesting. The People's Choice one is Broccoli Purple Magic, and it is also an AAS winner. So it won through our trials, and the reason it won the Green Thumb Award is the unique purple coloration. So quite often a purple broccoli will either have purple heads and a green stem or green heads and a purple stem. Well, this one has both. It has the purple heads and purple stem.
Finally did it. You got both.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. And what's really cool is with a lot of purple vegetables, if you just lightly steam them, they'll keep that purple coloration. If you boil them like crazy, well, then, yeah, the purple
goes
coloring
away.
Is gonna,
yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's so disappointing. I think we've all done that. We've bought that wonderful colored cauliflower, whatever, and then you cook it and it's gone.
So, right, right.
Yeah, but this is a gorgeous, really, really pretty. It's so pretty, it could almost be a flower, seriously. Very
yes,
nice.
You could use it as a centerpiece before, you know,
yeah.
I've seen that done where
yep.
people make cut flower arrangements with it. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Absolutely. So what is the taste? Have you been able to taste it? Is it better than?
I have not been able to taste it. I want to grow it this year. But what the judges were saying with All America Selections is that it was really an amazing, good broccoli taste. No bitterness to it. It was sweet. The stems weren't woody or stalky or anything. So it sounds like overall they really kept taste as part of it while they were breeding in the purple coloration.
Great. And what did the professionals have to say? What was their favorite?
So they chose a basil, and this one is called Everleaf Lemon. There is a series called Everleaf, which are powdery mildew resistant. And what I think is really cool about this one, just me personally, when I make pesto with my Genovese basil, I always add a touch of lemon juice for that light, fresh flavor. Well, this one has it built in. So
nice.
I have grown this one, and I used maybe 25-30% of these lemon basil leaves with my regular Genovese, and then I didn't have to add any lemon juice. But that's the whole idea, is the flavor behind it. And then this Everleaf series, the plants don't get leggy. They've got short internodes, you know, between each leaf stem.
Mm-hmm.
It's shorter, and so it puts out a massive number of leaves, so it makes harvest super easy and very productive.
And it looks like it's beautiful, so it would almost make a great, like, under bigger plants kind of a thing. It's really pretty. I'd like to grow this myself. Is that going to be readily available for us, or do we have to go to
yes,
a special?
It
will be. Okay.
No, I think if you go online and just search for seeds, you will be able to find them available.
Okay, wonderful. Look forward to that. Chris emailed us to thank us for mentioning the butterfly bush and the hellebore, but he's wondering whether or either of these are for zone 4, because he lives in... He or she, sorry, Chris, live in northern Grant County along the Wisconsin River, and they're in a solid zone 4. Now, from what I see on here, yeah, it's 5 to 9, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it is. The hellebore, both of them are 5 to 9.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing I would recommend is if you're daring and you want to kind of push it, you could try it maybe on the south side right next to a building, give it some winter protection, or we talked about that buddleia. You could grow in containers, pull it into your garage, and if your garage is a little bit more protected or semi-heated or something, you might be able to overwinter, but you'd be taking a chance.
Yeah, and always. And, well, things are changing, so maybe in a few years it'll be a little bit warmer up there, Chris. Thanks,
yeah,
thanks
well,
so
we
much
hope
for
not, but
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. You just don't know these days. So
right.
Let's see. So which other category we need to talk about? Houseplants.
I think we should talk about shrubs and houseplants.
Oh, shrubs, yeah,
right.
Okay. Whichever one you want to try first, go ahead.
Okay, well, you mentioned houseplants, and this one was a winner in both categories, so that's fun. It's called Philodendron Prismacolor Orange You Gorgeous. Sounds like a knock-knock joke, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It's
and
a beauty.
It is. It's that orange coloration, a rusty orange rosy coloration, the veins in the middle of the leaves, and then a little bit on the outer margins as well. So it's a typical philodendron. It's very variegated. I want to say that.
Yes.
It's not a solid color green. So it has the kind of a lemon yellow, a lemon green, and then a nice chartreuse green with some of the orange veining in it. They call it mottled.
Yes, and that's a perfect description. But I can see how this would really brighten up a space, and such a contrast to our normal green of a houseplant.
Right. And in January, you know, it's kind of gray in January. Yeah, so bring that in, and you're right, it would brighten everything up.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And like you said, this was for both professional and for the people's choice. Now, with shrubs, you got two different ones on that one, right?
Yes, we do. So the people's choice, no surprises, a hydrangea. I'm telling you, hydrangea is the number one thing for us when we are doing blogs and webinars. But this one, this is probably really good news for Chris. It's Hardy to Zones 3. It comes from a breeder in Minnesota, so I know that they breed for hardiness. It's called Flowerful Smooth. So it's a smooth hydrangea, and it has bold white blooms. It is just covered. So the whole thing here is more blooms and nice white bloom heads.
And it says it's disease resistant and low maintenance, which is always nice. And it's only 3 to 4 feet tall, so it's fairly compact for a hydrangea.
Exactly. Yeah, you could plant a whole row of them at that size. So it would make a nice addition to the yard.
It has been amazing over the last few years, all the different varieties of hydrangeas that are out there and how people are really loving them.
You are so right. And like I said, if we do a webinar, it's always our most attended or highest viewed webinar, our blogs, it gets more comments. So people just love their hydrangeas. They are in the limelight right now.
Yes, they are. And Little Limelight is a very good variety too.
I was going to say, I said that and I was like, that's another good variety.
Yes, it is. So let's go on to the professionals. What did they come up with?
Okay, so the professionals were looking at this one, and it's a burning bush, Eunomus, and it's called Fireball Seedless. So it is the only seedless, sterile, invasive burning bush currently on the market. So, we kind of talked about that with Buddleia, and the breeders are very aware. There are some places where it's important that you know. And so this one is Hardy Zones 4 through 8, has all the great color, all the same durability, but it is sterile and non-invasive.
And that is music to a lot of people's ears here in Wisconsin, because I believe that is on the invasive list. And we can have that beautiful plant and that beautiful color without having to worry about it invading our forest. That is really good news.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, one of the last category, which I was surprised to even see, is garden products. Why did you decide that this was a good category?
Well, there's a lot of new products that are being designed to make our lives easier as gardeners. So we're always looking for something where it was created and it solves a problem. And this one's kind of twofold. If you've heard of Crescent, they make a lot of self-watering containers. So that has me sold. I don't have to worry about
yes.
it. I just fill the reservoir and it does the work for me. Then the other thing about this one is it is created from a product that is keeping things out of the landfill. So it's upcycled from landfill waste. So that's got to feel good for all of us. Less going into the landfill. We're using a recycled product. And then they also are self-watering. So the name of this collection is called Crescent 2, T-O-O, Circular Positive Planter Collection. So it's circular, meaning doesn't go in the land waste, it comes back out, and it's all positive.
And it's very nice to look at.
The
design is really sleek, but there's also a traditional version of it that's a little bit more like a clay pot, but in these, and does it come in colors, I would assume?
I think they do. When they first came out, they had one color, and I'm thinking there are 3 or 4 colors.
Okay.
I'd have to check on that for you, but typically they do bring things out in multiple colors.
Sure, sure. And this one that I'm looking at is sort of a gray, which goes with pretty much everything, I guess. So,
that's great. And it makes the colors pop. Then.
Yes,
you know,
for
when
sure.
you have a very neutral container, it doesn't try to
fight.
Take over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, earlier you had talked about with the purple broccoli that it was an AAS winner. Can you explain what that means and how it's different from the Green Thumb Award winners?
Yeah, so AAS winners, the breeders are coming out, you know, with new varieties all the time, and they want to enter it into our trials. So these literally, we get the seed here in our office, we get comparison varieties, and we send them out to a network of more than 80 judges across the U.S. We have 7 different trials. You know, we have edibles, we have annuals, we have perennials, et cetera. And so our judges then grow this entry side by side with something that's already on the market. And what they're doing is they're saying, okay, well, and let's just take this broccoli, for example. We're growing it next to this. How is it for taste? How is it for productivity? How is it for disease resistance? And, you know, is the purple good? Does it have purple on the head and the stem? So our judges look at that. They submit their ratings, their scores through an app on their phone, and then we do the mathematical. Well, we don't do it. It's all automated. and this mathematical equation determines whether or not it's an AAS winner. If it scores high enough, then the breeder tells us if they have enough seed. And if they do, then we announce it as an AAS winner. And we usually have anywhere from, 15 to 25 winners every year that we announce, and then we market them.
Oh, that's amazing. So then there's a list somewhere that people can take, you know, look at and say, where can I find these, or this would work great for me?
Yes. AASwinners.com. And so then when you go there, you just search by AAS winners. You can search by year, or you can go in and say, I want to find all Celosia, and you can search by Celosia. Then when you look at each individual winner page, if it's been on the market long enough, you know, we will list companies like Park Seed or Seeds and Such or Jung Seed. They're a wonderful supporter of All America Selections. And we'll provide some links to their websites where you can actually purchase them.
Oh, perfect. So that's easy enough to do. Wonderful. Now let's go back to the National Garden Bureau. There's always a proclamation of this is the year of the caladium, apparently, is one of them. How does that get selected?
Oh, this one is super interesting. Now, we've been doing this for over 45 years, and this is something, again, that our members determine. You know, we look at these different plant genera, and we say, well, which one is popular? You know, when cauliflower came about a couple years ago, where it was just like there were cauliflower shortages and cauliflower pizza crust and buffalo, you know.
Yes.
So what we did was we said, well, it's going to be the year of the brassica that year because it was so popular. So we look at popularity. We look at things that are easy to grow relatively. We look and see, has there been some new breeding work? You know, we were just talking about Buddleia and that burning bush. So last year it was the year of the Buddleia. We've got burning bush on our plans for the future. So we want new work being done. We want it easy to grow. We want it applicable to a lot of people. You know, perennials are a little bit more regional specific, but we try to make them as inclusive as we can. And we have 6 different categories. So we have an annual, a perennial, a flowering shrub, a bulb crop, an edible, and a houseplant. So those are the 6 things we focus on every year.
Okay. Well, let's go over them real quick. We have time.
Okay. So our perennial is the Asclepias, the butterfly weed, I guess. I hate to call it that,
but it is
the Asclepias. And the reason we chose that is the huge interest in monarch butterflies. So we want to tell people more about the different Asclepias that are available. Then you had mentioned the caladium. So our bulb crop is the caladium. And there's a huge interest right now in foliage. You know, just growing for foliage.
Yes.
And then we also noticed a year or so ago, a huge interest in shade gardening. And so we were like, well, that kind of fits both. So we've got the year of the caladium, and those are wonderful. And then our annual is a calendula. And a lot of people are growing their own cut flowers. They want to bring them in. And there has been a surge in small flower growers, flower farmers, you know, that are growing for farmers markets or wedding florists. So calendula fits that. Our flowering shrub is the dogwood. And until I read this article, I was like, wow, I didn't know that much about dogwoods. You've got trees, but you also have the shrubs. So we're focusing more on the shrub for that, the smaller trees. For houseplant, it's the year of the Monstera. And again, this one, it kind of went haywire during COVID, and these Monstera were selling for thousands of dollars. And it's been interesting. There's been a lot of growers that are now making the Monstera more readily available at a more affordable price. So we wanted to tell people about Monstera. We had a webinar about it a couple weeks ago. It was probably one of the most entertaining webinars I've ever done and very informative. And then last but not least is the year of the pea. So grow some peas, grow snap peas, grow shelling peas. It's interesting that we have a European counterpart. They are also promoting 2025 as the year of the pea. So,
well, who knew?
Exactly,
that's
right. The
exciting.
Popular pea.
Popular pea. Absolutely. Yeah. Long as they're not mushy, I'm there.
Right.
So how are those chosen? Just a collective of people who know what they're doing?
Yes, and it is our members. So we try not to duplicate things too frequently. We say it has to be at least a decade. You know, it was 14 years ago we did the Year of the Tomato, and everybody loves tomatoes, so
sure.
Everybody's clamoring for us to do it again because there continues to be additional breeding work. So it is by our members' choice. So they're the ones that vote on this. We've got this little internal voting mechanism we use. But we're thinking about maybe in the next year or so, we're going to try to get the home gardener involved. We're going to say, hey, which one of these bulb crops would you like to learn more about?
Yeah.
And we'll see what their feedback is.
Yeah, so I bet you'll get a lot.
I think we will, too.
Yeah.
I guarantee you the flowering shrub will be hydrangea, but we've already done that. We need to give love to the other flowering shrub.
There you go. So your members for the National Garden Bureau are professional growers. Is that who the members are?
They are professionals on the commercial side. So they're breeders, they're brokers, distributors, they are the retailers, they're the growers. And then we have another separate category, which I think is very interesting for everybody, like book authors or podcast hosts. So we are able to, you know, give them some publicity and send some people to their websites because we know our members are the experts in their field. You know, they're on the professional side, and then they're on this outreach communication media side. So they have some wonderful books and podcasts and online courses. So, yeah, we have about, it's almost 200 members now that come from the horticulture industry.
Oh, that's great. And there's a lot of information on your website. So tell us about what people can find there.
Well, it's funny you say that because I literally hopped off a call with our web designer to get on this call, and she's like, your website's so huge. It's so many megabytes or gigabytes, I guess it was. So, yes, there is a lot of information. You had given the address, ngb.org. One of the things we didn't even really talk about, which is our new plants program, and I said hydrangeas was one of our most popular webinars, but our even most popular is the one where I, for an hour, talk about 180 different new varieties.
Oh,
the
my.
Green thumbs are subsets of those.
Okay.
But, yeah, we have 180 new varieties, pretty much that number every year, and it's under the new plants program. These come direct from the breeders, and they are just now hitting the market. So if you want to really go in there and salivate over all these new tomatoes and petunias and shrubs and hydrangeas, that's where you would go. And that's one of our main programs.
Oh, that's wonderful. You really get psyched about spring,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When you get are exposed to that. Now, you have a newsletter, too. Does that go out to just anybody or is that just to your members?
No, that's really it's on behalf of our members. So usually what we're doing is sending information out to home gardeners about our products or giving them tips or giving them summaries of our webinars. So we have a blog, and then that blog gets turned into our newsletter, and we send it out pretty much every Friday January through May. And then, like I said, it's a seasonal thing. So as people are out in their garden, they're not opening newsletters.
Right.
So we back off a little bit in the summer. And then by the time it gets to like November, I think we only do one a month. Just, you know, people are thinking about the holidays and not about their garden.
Right, right. Sometimes that happens with us with callers because people are out in their gardens. They're listening, but they're... You're gardening. They're not calling in with their questions. So understandable.
Right, right.
Understandable. Excuse me. Now, I noticed that you have a section on your front page about grants that you give to therapeutic gardens. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, now you're tugging at the heartstrings. This is a wonderful program we started about 10 years ago, and it's our way of giving back to something that's related to everything else we do. And so therapeutic gardens, again, they were started years ago, and they kind of waned, and then they got a resurgence around the Vietnam War, and then they waned, and they've gotten a big resurgence again. In fact, you know, I'm looking at exactly what you are on our website, and it is amazing how the hobby of gardening can help people with mental and physical disabilities. It can be used as therapy. It can just be used to teach social skills and everything. So, yeah, we give away $7,500 every year to five different gardens, and it's based on how many votes they get once we put it out on our website and we start to tell their stories. But this is something we are very proud of and will continue for the foreseeable future of giving back to these gardens so they can use the hobby of gardening or the profession of gardening to help those in need.
And I shout out to the Edgerton Hospital Garden. I think it was a 2023 winner.
Yes.
Mark Dwyer, who is the director down there, has been with us for years. And so we've been hearing about that garden for a while, and it was really wonderful when they won that award. So they do great things that those therapeutic gardens. It's like you said, it's amazing what gardening can do for you.
It does, yeah, both physically and mentally. And you're right, I've toured Mark's garden, I think it was last summer, and they have done so much with that space, and the fact that they make it available to the public as well as to their patients and everything, it's a great program.
It really is. And we want to thank you for your leadership on some really great programs too, Diane. Thank you for being with us, and I'm sure we'll do this again.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Okay, bye-bye. We were talking to Diane Blazek. She's Executive Director of All America Selections and National Garden Bureau. But stay with us because Joel Carson's back with us, and he's going to be talking about straw bale gardening. Been talking about straw bale gardening on Garden Talk for years, and it's time to catch up with the inventor of the method. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your day with us. And back with us is Joel Carson. He's traveled across the world introducing the straw bale garden method, and he's written a number of best-selling books on the topic. What are your questions about straw bale gardens? Have straw bales changed the way that you grow? We'll join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Joel, it's so good to talk with you again.
It's good to be back on with you, Joel.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're missing a layer like 2 years in a row.
Oh, well.
He's already
a straw bale gardening expert. So
he is. He does a straw bale, at least one straw bale every year. So, yeah, he's been doing it for a long time. I've tried a few times myself to mixed review, but mostly it's been my problem because I just haven't done it right. So I think we need to kind of, you know, go over the basics for people, of course. So for those who haven't tried it, why don't you explain the process?
Well, first of all, the name's a little bit elusive because when you say straw bale gardening, we're going to plant into straw bales, people think right away, well, your plants, how does a plant grow in straw?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really growing in straw. That's the trick, is the inside of the bale is going to become compost very quickly. And we're going to do that by this process we call conditioning. But it's really composting the inside of the bale. And you do this by adding a source of nitrogen, and then you add a little water, and you feed the bacteria that are already in the bale. And those bacteria quickly will colonize the bale, and you'll know this is happening. You can't see them, unfortunately, because you need a microscope for that, but you can feel them. They'll start to replicate, and as they replicate, they tend to warm up the bale. So the inside of the bale will get warmer than air temperature, and you know at that point that it's happening. The bale is conditioning. And after a couple of weeks, the bale will start to cool off again, and you know that that colonization has been completed, and the inside of the bale is then going to have free ions and cations. What that means is it's broken. The bacteria has broken down the cells of the straw and broken those cells back into nutrient molecules, things you would recognize like nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, molybdenum, zinc, iron, manganese. All of the macro and micronutrients that a plant needs to grow will now be available inside that bale from decomposed cells of the straw. So that's where the nutrients come from, not from us adding fertilizer all summer, but from the decomposing straw that releases its molecules for a new plant to absorb and be able to grow.
It's like magic.
Yes, it is. It is like magic. If you had a microscope, you could really follow along. But you just got to kind of trust the process that this is going to work. And if anybody does fail or not have as much success, it's usually because of that conditioning process. That's really important to get that process right, that first two-week process of breaking the bales down and letting nature sort of take its course. Oftentimes people will start too early. Like you and I might get excited because it's been warm out the last couple of days here in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So we might get started early. And then what happens is the bacteria start growing, but then it gets real cold and it'll shut down that process. And they don't get the, you don't get the full colonization. So you got to wait till it warms up. I usually tell people to target 20 days before your location's average last frost date. And that's when you would start this process. And that's usually going to give you a really nice weather window where you're going to get a few days up to 65 or 70 degrees. And that only takes, you know, 1 or 2 days of real nice warm temperatures, like 70 degrees, for that entire colonization to happen. But if you start a couple weeks earlier than that, you might not ever get warm enough outside temperatures, in order to spark that growth of bacteria inside the bales. And once you get that part done, now we just plant right into the bales. You know, transplants like tomatoes, things that usually you would start in advance from seed, either in your greenhouse or in the house, or you'd buy it at the garden center. Those kind of things, you just take the pot off and you plant the roots right into the bale itself. If you're doing things from seed, peas and beans, squash, things like that from seed, usually you can just plant those seeds directly in the bale. If they're a big seed, you know, if they're as big as the end of your finger, you can push them right down into that bale of straw, and they'll in 3 days, they'll start to germinate right out of the bale. If you're planting tiny seeds, however, like carrots or basil, for instance, those kind of things, you want to make a seed bed. But what we don't want to do is introduce soil from our garden, because if you just put a shovel of soil on top of the bale, now you're going to bring along with that weed seeds, which we're trying to avoid. You might bring disease or insects that are harboring in that soil over winter. So we just use a little thin layer of potting mix that you buy at the garden center, and water that thin layer in, and then maybe put a little bit more on top so you get a nice nest of that potting mix on top of the bale. And then you seed your carrots or your basil or whatever tiny seed you're doing into that layer on the top, that 1-inch little layer, and they'll root right down into the bale at that point.
So
it doesn't take very long.
The soil is just basically there so the seed doesn't go like all the way through the bale, right?
Right. Otherwise, you know, you drop a tiny little basil or a carrot, there's enough airspace in that bale that it could fall halfway through into the bale. But a big seed like a pea or a bean, you know, you poke those in with your finger and it's big enough that it'll hold right in position. And then as soon as it germinates, the roots hold it in place. So it's fine.
Then you're fine. So I think a question that we get a lot of times is, which side of the bale do you use?
Well, I like to put the bale so the strings are on the side. And that's sometimes people think, well, that doesn't make sense because the flattest part, the biggest surface of the bale is on the same side where the strings are. So I want that up. I got more surface area to plant. But the reality is we're going to plant the sides of the bale as well as the top. So if you have the narrow side on the top, you can get a row of whatever down the middle, and then you can also plant into the sides of that bale. If you plant the sides, of course, you're going to need to use transplants of some kind, something you bought in a flat that has a root already established. If you put a seed in the side of the bale, it'll want to grow up, and that's going to be planted way too deep, you know, if you planted it in the middle of the bale. So things you do in the side, I do lots of herbs I'll do in the side. I've done kale, other things that kind of bush out and will turn up. I've actually planted cabbage in the side of the bales, believe it or not.
Really?
And that works well. Yeah, that works well. So you're going to plant the top and the sides. I like to put the cut side of the bale. Now, if there's any farm kids out there, they'll know there's a cut side and a folded side on every bale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you rode on a baling rack when you were a little kid, you learned quickly, because if you bounce that bale off your leg on the pokey side, on the cut side, you get a big rash on your leg.
That's right. So,
but city kids sometimes don't know that. But you put the cut side of the bale up, that prickly side. That's the side you want up. It's just much easier to get water to enter the bale and get your blood meal, if you're organic, or your fertilizer, if you're not organic, to get that to melt into the bale and provide the nitrogen for those bacteria down inside the bale.
So let's talk about that, you know, conditioning, as you call it. What do you do?
Okay, it takes about 2 weeks, a little less time if you're using like a lawn fertilizer that's got a lot of powerful nitrogen in it, and it melts easily. If you're doing like an organic, usually blood meal is what we recommend for the organic gardeners, that takes a little longer, because first the fertilizer has to be broken down by the bacteria, and then the nitrogen molecules can be used by other bacteria to facilitate this decomposition process. So it takes about, we recommend you give yourself 18 days if you're doing it organically before you're going to be ready to plant. If you're doing it using the more stronger fertilizer, like the lawn fertilizer, you can do that in, usually ready to plant in 12 days. And this is starting now 20 days before last frost. So if you do the math with me here, you're actually going to be planting before your last frost. And people always wonder, how can I plant before my last frost? What if it freezes? You know, I still have potential frost for another 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But the advantage is that bale is nice and warm. You know, as it's decomposing, often these bales will get 135 degrees inside the bale. And then it'll cool down. You'll plant when it gets under 100, but it'll still be, you know, 75, 80, 90 degrees inside that bale for another week or two until you're way past your potential last frost in the spring.
Excuse me. I think I'm getting Larry's cold. Go ahead.
So the process of conditioning is really pretty simple. You know, the first application you're going to put on, you're just going to sprinkle it on, and we sprinkle this. We actually make a product now called Bale Buster, if anybody's, you know, concerned about what to buy. If you don't have a copy of one of my books that explains what kind of fertilizer you can use, that if you just go to your local store, you can buy. Or you can order our stuff called Bale Buster. And they sprinkle it on edge to edge, end to end, and you water it in. And initially, when you first start, you're going to really wet that bale, put a lot of water on it, you know, until you almost see water coming out the bottom of the bale. So it probably takes, you know, 2 minutes or 3 minutes with the hose on each bale. But after that, you're only going to add 1 gallon of water to each bale every time you add the fertilizer. And then in between days, you want to water also. So basically, it's getting a gallon of water on each bale. That's like 30 seconds with your hose, is usually plenty. And then every other day, you're going to add the fertilizer. And by the 12th day, you'll see that bale will have heated up already and will have started to cool down by that 12th day and usually ready to plant. How do you tell if it's warm enough? Well, if you got a compost thermometer, that's wonderful. If you don't, just use your God-given meat thermometer, your hand, and shove your hand right down in the bale. And if it feels warm on your hand, you should be, if you're healthy, you should be 98.6 degrees. So if it feels warm on your hand, it's probably above 100 degrees in that bale still. So it's too warm to plant. But if it feels cool or even tepid, room temperature to your hand, then it's probably fine to plant. So you can go ahead and plant at that point. Usually that's about the 12th day. Plants are pretty forgiving. Usually what I tell people is if you're on the fence and you're questioning, is it too warm to plant in the bale or not, just put one thing in the bale. Don't plant your whole garden in one day.
That's a good idea.
Too warm, you might lose a bunch of plants. Where if you just put one thing in there and then just watch it, you know, 6 hours later, if it starts to wilt, you know you're in trouble. Pull it back out.
That's
and wait
right.
another day for that bale.
Perfect.
For that bale to cool down.
That's
yep.
what I call science, Joel. So we're going to be taking a little bit of a break here for the news, but we'll be back with all kinds of more information. So stay with us. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and today is our annual chat with straw bale founder, a gardening founder, Joel Karsten. He has traveled across the world introducing this method and has written a number of best-selling books on the topic. Do you have questions about using straw bales in your gardens? Have you tried it, but maybe have not gotten good results? Well, tell us about it. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Joel, before we broke, you were talking about conditioning the bale. Did we get everything in on that?
I think we did. One of the questions that people often ask, however, is why? Why would you do a straw bale garden when you could just plant in your soil? Well, if you have a beautiful garden already with, you know, beautiful, rich, black soil, maybe you don't want to do straw bale gardening. But for anybody who's in a situation where they don't have good soil, this is a really great alternative. And you can do a straw bale garden literally on top of asphalt or concrete or on a rooftop. Or, you know, if you got terrible soil or contaminated soil, you could put a barrier on the ground and then put bales on top of that to be able to have a garden in places where most people would never attempt to have a garden. There's a bunch of other big advantages. You know, it's raised up off the ground, so you get the advantages of a raised bed for a $5 bale of straw rather than having to build actual raised beds. You also get a lot of moisture retention. You know, a dry bale of straw will suck up and hold between 5 and 7 gallons of water. So that's like a reservoir, like a tank inside that bale. Try and pick it up once when it's fully saturated. That's all water weight inside there. So it holds a lot of water. Moisture is a big thing. The other thing is less weeding. You know, there's no weed seeds in that bale. There might be a couple leftover oats or a couple leftover wheat seeds, but as soon as those sprout, you can pluck those out of the top. Sometimes there's none in there. If you got a farmer with a good combine, they won't leave any seeds behind. But if you do have any seeds, you pluck those out. And the rest of the summer, you're going to go without pulling a single weed in your vegetable garden, which for a lot of people who garden, that's the reason they don't have as big a garden as they used to, is because they hate pulling weeds all summer.
Very true.
You don't have to bend over as much. So for anybody with any kind of physical limitations, even as we get older, it gets harder and harder to bend over or get down on the ground. Or as my grandma Josephine used to say, getting down is easy. It's getting up where
right.
I have trouble. So it's much easier to garden from a physical standpoint. You also don't have those residual soil-borne diseases. You know, if you get tomato blight, you can't plant tomatoes in that same soil for, what do they say, 5 or 7 years or something until that blight goes away. With straw bale gardening, you don't have to worry about that because you're going to get a new bale for your tomatoes. You're probably going to use new bales every year, and then you're going to use the second-year bales that you used for tomatoes last year. This year, you're going to use them for planting potatoes or carrots or beets or any of your root crops or cool-season crops can go in those second-season bales. And so you usually get a 2-year rotation out of bales pretty easily. It's with straw bales. If you use hay bales, which will work, but hay bales usually only get 1 year just because they decompose really quickly. And it basically will become soil over one season, and you'll just have a little hump of soil there for the next year. So you can spread that around in your flower gardens or whatever and till it into the soil. It really helps improve the tilth of any soil. You know, if it's a sandy or a clay soil, it'll really improve that soil. So that's the basic.
We did get a couple of emails. Paul in Port Wing emailed us and was wondering, how do you stop ants from invading straw bales?
You won't. Just like ants come in a regular garden. Ants are going to go away with, they're going to capture and help decompose dead organic material. It's very rare that you'll see ants eating live plant material. Usually they're eating something that's dead. And they really don't have a negative effect. A lot of times they'll also eat aphids. So if you have any aphids in your garden, ants are going to be helpful. They'll help clear those out. So in most cases, unless it's fire ants, you know, I do hear from people, my southern gardeners, that they've gotten fire ants. And we do have a solution you can mix up and pour on there. It's Dawn dish soap and some orange oil in a gallon of water. It's actually the University of Georgia came up with this recipe. And you just pour it over the bale, douse it really good, and it helps if you heat the water up. That also helps. And the fire ants will leave the bale at that point. So there is solutions for that. But in normal situations, if you're just talking about normal ants, they're really not going to hurt anything at all.
Okay, great. And Julie in Hixton emailed to ask how you can manage slugs in the straw bales. Last year, they decimated her carrots and her marigolds.
Yeah, slugs seem to be very cyclical. You know, if you get those years where you get a lot of sultry nights where it's hot and humid every night, the slugs in a straw bale will tend to thrive. There's a couple of solutions. You can use slug bait, which is basically iron phosphate, little tiny kernels of it, I guess you'd call it, pill-shaped kernels. You can sprinkle that around your bale and around the plants, and that will help prevent the slugs from crawling over that iron phosphate because that will tend to kill them. You can use copper on top of your gardens, like I've even seen people do a circle of copper pennies around a plant, and that will keep the slugs away. But some of the simplest methods are put a board on the ground right next to the bale. And then the next morning, early in the morning, just flip that board over, and you'll see a whole bunch of slugs have accumulated under that board. And you can squash them or capture them and put them in a bag and throw them in the garbage, get them out of your garden. Upside down, like if you got an orange and you cut the orange in half, just put the upside down orange halves on top of the bales. And in the morning, flip those over and you'll see a whole collection of slugs underneath those. So it's sort of real simple but practical ways. People will also embed little jars and then pour some beer in the jars. And those slugs will crawl right in the little baby food jar or whatever, and they'll drown in the beer. But some other people claim that's a waste of good beer. So I guess you never know.
But what a way to go for those little slugs.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we've got a call from Jim and Nina. Go right ahead, Jim.
Yes, I was wondering about using the straw bale gardening because our fruit trees. Nina has a real bad case of clay for soil, and can it be used to season that clay to make it better?
Yes, absolutely. Use it right over top of the clay soil, plant in the bales. You'll see most of the time the roots of the plants, with the exception of things like tomatoes, which have a really deep root, those will grow down through the bale and actually probably try to grow into that clay soil. But in most cases, you'll have all the roots of your plants will be harbored inside the bales. So it doesn't even matter what soil you put it over top of. As I mentioned earlier, I've seen people do this on a concrete driveway or an asphalt driveway. So you really don't need much for soil at all underneath. It's just there to hold the bale in position. Sometimes if you have soil that has been a garden or has been a lawn in the past, you're going to get lots of weeds or grass growing between the rows of bales. So you'll need to deal with that space. Maybe put some landscape fabric down or some cardboard boxes, you know, thick layers. I like to keep the rows of bales about 5-6 feet apart between the rows, give you plenty of space for sun and for the plants to grow and expand. I've had lots of people call me and say, oh, I put them 4 feet apart, and now I can't walk down the road between the bales because it's all full of plants. So don't make that mistake. Keep them plenty far apart. Give yourself plenty of room and cover that space in between. Then you don't have to deal. Or you can mow it, I guess, if you wanted to, but then you can't have, like, squash because squash are going to come off that bale, especially pumpkins, and crawl all over the ground. And then you have grass growing up through your squash, so that would be difficult. But otherwise, you'll be just fine. Clay soil won't matter at all.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jim. Good luck. I hope you
try that.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, kind of getting out of control, I think we've had a lot of callers who've said, I put, like, 4 tomato plants in my bale, and they're all over the place, right? Well, how do you judge what you should put into that bale?
You know, if you're doing hybrid tomatoes, the ones that have an indeterminate vine, so they'll just keep growing. You know, by the end of summer, they're heading towards your neighbor's yard up the street. So they get real long. Those, you only want to put one in a bale, mainly because they're going to take up a lot of space above the bale. It's not the not the space in the bale for the roots, but it's the space above the bale where they're going to grow the vines and hang on your trellis that you're going to put above the row of bales. It's going to fill in that space. And if you had more than one, what's going to happen is you're going to get the same total number of tomatoes because you only have so much space for vine, and it's only going to collect so much sunlight. So your tomatoes will tend to shrink in size, and you won't have as many tomatoes per plant if you double stack them in a bale. Now, with heirloom tomatoes, you know, sometimes those heirlooms only give you 8 to 15 tomatoes on a plant, and they don't get that big. You know, they're determinate size. So those you could easily get two in a bale. But the big boys, early girls, things that are hybrid tomatoes that are going to give you a lot of tomatoes. I mean, you get 80 to 150 tomatoes off of one plant in many circumstances with these hybrids nowadays. Those you only want one in a bale. And then you're probably going to have to, at some point during the season when it gets real hot and you're really juicing a whole bunch of tomatoes on that vine, you probably have to water that bale twice a day.
Oh, okay.
So that's why an irrigation system, like a drip system that you can set on a timer, works really well. You just turn it on. You don't want to water a lot every time you water. Only add a gallon, gallon and a half, maybe 2 gallons at the most, and that'll replenish the reservoir in that bale. If you water too long, what happens, Jill, is water will run through the bale, and it'll carry out soluble nutrients. So it'll leach your nitrogen right out of the bale, and then your plants turn yellow and you end up having to add artificial fertilizer, where if you just limit how much water you put on, don't put so much water on every time you water, you won't flush the bales at all and you won't need to fertilize throughout the summer. So it has enough fertility in that bale itself.
And that's probably one of the mistakes that new straw bale gardeners make, isn't it? Too much water.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest mistake new straw bale gardeners make is they tend to overwater. You know, with a regular garden, you can water and then you can see a puddle build up around your plants. And they'll say, oh, I got a puddle. It's time to stop watering. You can never see that in a bale because it's just running down out the bottom and it disappears. And a lot of times you don't even notice that you've overwatered. But yeah, anything more than a gallon or a gallon and a half per bale per application is probably too much water. It doesn't take very long. Think about your spigot's going to give you 2 gallons a minute, right?
Right.
If you got a 10-bale garden, that's only 5 minutes of water at 2 gallons a minute, and you got a gallon on each bale, you know, pretty quickly. I'll have people that'll call me, and they'll say, I don't know about this straw bale gardening. I've been watering my garden for 2 hours every morning and every night,
and
it doesn't look good at all. And I tell them, I want you to hold a cold water hose over your head for 2 hours and call me back and tell me how you feel. You know, you're killing these poor plants from all this water you're putting on. It's leaching all the nutrients out, and your plants are starving for nutrients because of all this leaching. So,
well, what happens when you have, like, a really rainy period?
You just turn the water off. Don't run your irrigation. I'm in Minnesota, and you know you're not far away from me there in Wisconsin. Last summer, I did not even turn my irrigation on until the beginning of August, first weekend in August, because we had rains every week all spring and throughout the summer. And then early August, the rains stopped coming, and it got a little hotter, and I had, you know, big tomatoes and eggplants and things. Then at that point, I started turning my irrigation on for 3 minutes, I think, on each zone early in the morning. I got a drip system, so each plant's getting about 3/4 of a gallon, probably. Uh-huh. That was plenty. Got me through the season. By early September, mid-September, I shut the irrigation off, and that was it. Mm-hmm. The lowest water bill I've had in years for irrigating my garden.
Yeah, nice. Well, it was an interesting gardening year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really a good season for me. I mean, a lot of people who soil garden had too much water early in the spring, and they got a lot of drown outs and a lot of, you know, disease problems because of so much water. But for me, it was a great year last year. So.
Yeah, it started very, very wet very early, and then it definitely did dry out. So, yeah, it was the best of both worlds, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, tell us about some of the innovations that you've come up with to use bales, you know, like some of the hoop houses and things like that.
Well, we do have plans on our website for these little greenhouses people can build about a little later than now. You don't want to quite get it up yet, but I call it an April greenhouse. In my manuscript for my book, I called it an April greenhouse. And my publishers wrote back and said, You can't call it an April greenhouse because, remember, we sell books in Australia, too, in New Zealand. So you need to come up with a different name. So I called it my six-week greenhouse, which there is really, it's kind of a shoulder season greenhouse. And you want to set it up about 6 weeks before planting day. And this just involves two cattle panels humped over. So you got $50 in cattle panels. And then you put some 4 mil poly that you can buy at, you know, any hardware store, painter's poly. You don't need the good stuff because this is only going to last for a year. It's only going to last for 6 weeks. And then you can use it again next year probably. And then we put six bales inside of these little humped up cattle panels. And these bales, once you start conditioning them, will get hot, and that warms your greenhouse. So I show you on the plans how you can build little end panels on the greenhouse. So it's like $100 investment for this greenhouse, but it's a great way to start your seedlings outside in a greenhouse rather than having to do them in the house. You know, if you get sunlight early spring, April sun is really bright, and, you know, by the time you get to the end of April, you get a lot of intense sunlight. So it keeps that greenhouse nice and warm. And you'll see your seedlings do really well with that bottom heat from the bales and then the natural sunlight outside. So a little tiny greenhouse like that, you can start 300 or 400 vegetable plants real easily in flats in that kind of a greenhouse. And then we do lots of innovation. I mean, we've had, around the world, I was just in Switzerland on vacation a few months ago, and it reminded me, I had this woman named Ushi who's lives on top of halfway up a mountain in Switzerland, and terrible soil, you know, awful environment to have a garden. But she started straw bale gardening, where she just puts these bales following the slope. So it's a pretty steep slope, like, you know, 12-14% slope. And she grows her garden on the side of a mountain in Switzerland, and it has grand success. I mean, all kinds of production. And part of her story is really funny because these miners walk up her road every morning to go to work, and they would laugh at her. There's this young blonde Swedish girl out there planting in bales, and they laugh. They said, "This is never going to work." And then later in the season, she's standing there holding a whole bunch of vegetables in her arms one morning when they walk by. And she just smiled at them, and they got all interested in straw bale gardening after that.
I'll bet.
So on a steep slope, it works really well. You know, if you get an environment like one of the last callers, Jim, said, where they have just terrible soil, it's a great solution for that. I have a wonderful garden in New York, or in New Jersey, actually, right across the bay from Manhattan, in Kearney, New Jersey, the Kearney Community Garden. And they started 10 years ago, I believe. They have federally contaminated brown site underneath their straw bale garden. So underneath this garden, then on top, they have is contaminated soil. Then on top, they put this landscape, industrial landscape fabric. So it's like stuff they use when they build ponds as pond liner. They put this on top of the soil so no roots will ever grow down through and into that soil. Then they put wood chips on top and bales on top of that, and they've got a beautiful garden. This will be their 11th year.
Wow.
Of growing in an environment where you've got, you know, turned a federally contaminated brown site into a beautiful community garden.
Yeah, that can be used all over the place. And I know you've talked about areas where maybe bales aren't necessarily available, but you can kind of make your own with a plastic tub, right? Or other options.
You really can. If you're a DIYer and you don't have access to bales, it's really easy to make a bale out of leaves and grass clippings and, you know, your Valentine's Day flowers that are left over. Anything goes in that bin, make it in a, you know, dump all your Christmas decorations out and bring that great big plastic bin upstairs, put it in your garden, and then fill it full of all this leaf litter and grass clippings, whatever. Stomp it down really well, fill it up with water, put a rock on top so the stuff doesn't float out. And then the next day, tip that bin upside down, and you'll have this big square brick. And then you want to wrap that brick of organic matter with chicken wire. Everybody knows what chicken wire is, the little tiny hole wire. Wrap that around it and staple both ends onto a wooden stick, and then pound the end of that stick in the ground, or you can twist that stick, actually, and that'll help clamp, kind of tighten that wire up around the bale like a clamp, and then pound the end in the ground. And you've got your own bale you made, and actually those bales of mixed organic material like that will actually perform even better than a bale of wheat straw or a bale of oat straw. Because you got to remember, wheat only has a certain specific profile of nutrients in it, in the wheat itself. Same thing with oats or barley straw, or whatever you're using, where if you have a mixture of leaves and grass and all kinds of other, you know, weeds from your garden last summer or whatever, you put all those in just like it's a compost pile. Now you have a mixture of so many different nutrient molecules as those that plant material decomposes and breaks down that you have a wider variety of nutrients, and your plants will actually do even better in that bale than in a typical straw bale.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And wasn't there some area in Asia that you were doing, it was more like a pit?
Yes, we do. It's in Cambodia.
Okay.
It's actually a great story. If you're familiar with TED Talks, I did
yes.
a TED Talk about our project there. And we have one in Cambodia and one in the Philippines as well. But the Cambodia one's really interesting because they have floods really bad, everybody knows. And then they have drought right after the flood. So there's about a 5 or 6 month period where they can't grow fresh vegetables. And that causes lots of problems, especially for the very young kids that only have rice to eat during that 5 month period. They don't have any fresh vegetables. So how do you solve that problem? Well, you can't grow anything when it's raining 8 or 10 inches a day during the monsoon season. So what we did is we dug a pit in there in the farm, about 15 feet deep, 30 feet by 30 feet, and then piled all the soil from the pit right next to the pit. So we have a pit and a plateau. On top of the plateau, we build a straw bale garden. That plateau is always above the highest flood level. And they can plant into those bales because the bales drain so quickly that even though it rains 8 inches during the day, it'll stop raining. And within 10 or 15 minutes of when it stops raining, enough water, gravity has pulled water out of the bale and air comes back into the bale, which will keep the roots from rotting. If you plant it in the soil on top of that mound, you'd never get rid of the water because there's no drainage, and you'd get root rot in any vegetable that you tried to plant or grow. So in these bales, the water comes out, the plants do really well. So they grow squash and lots of leafy greens and this thing they call bitter gourd, which looks to me like a cucumber, but it's not. and lots of vegetables like that that have the niacin and vitamin C and iron and some protein as well in these vegetables that can supply their family with enough fresh vegetables during the monsoon season. Then when the drought season comes, there's no water anywhere except they got this big giant pit with 50,000 gallons in it. They can dunk water out with a pail, bring it up on top of the mound, and keep their garden watered by hand, and their garden will continue to live even through the hot, dry season. You know, it gets 110 degrees during the day, and they don't have pumps and electricity in rural Cambodia like we have. You know, they have to do anything they're going to carry water. It has to be by hand. And there really is no water. They carry a little bit of drinking water, and that's all they carry. They can't plant corn or any fresh vegetables until that drought season goes away. Then when the growing season comes, they're wonderful farmers. They plant rice fields, and the rice fields do marvelously. And then to get rid of the rice straw, what do? They usually burn it. Now they don't burn it. They bale it.
They bale it.
I sent them a YouTube link before I got there of how to make a hand baler. By the time I got to Cambodia, they had built a hand baler out of wood, and they put the straw in there, and they compress it down, make a bale, and then we put the bales on top of the mound. So when I started that project in Cambodia, we had no farmers that had ever even heard of straw bale gardening. Now we have over 10,000 farmers that are doing this throughout Cambodia.
That is absolutely amazing. If people need to know, they can get your books, right, if they want more information. You also have
right.
a great website,
absolutely.
Too, right?
Yes, strawbalegardenclub.com.
All right. That is as easy as it's going to get. And Joel, thank you so much for being with us again. We really appreciate it.
Boy, that went by quick. Thank
it
you
did.
So much,
I know.
Joel, for having me.
You
I appreciate
bet.
It. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Joel Karsten. He's the founder of Straw Bale Gardening. And you're going to find more about that method at strawbalegardenclub.com. Next week we're going to be at the Wisconsin PBS Garden and Green Living Expo live, and Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston will be there. Hope you can join us. Up next, you're going to hear an interview Larry did last year on growing ferns with horticulturist Moby Weinstein.
Ferns have been around for millions of years and are among the oldest plants on Earth, as a matter of fact. And next up, we talk with fern expert Moby Weinstein. We'll talk about the history of these well-loved plants. We look at their basic botany and how to care for them. And it's great to have Moby with us. She's foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor I should say, foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor Gardeners at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. She's a lecturer, a plant judge, and an author of two books on ferns. I have in front of me her book titled The Complete Book of Ferns, and I have really enjoyed going through this book. It's fascinating. Moby Weinstein, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So what is it about ferns that has drawn you to them?
Well, I didn't choose them per se at the very beginning. I just love all plants. And very early on in my career at the Botanical Garden in New York, I was assigned to take care of the ferns. So I said, well, if I'm going to take care of them, I need to know a little bit about them. And was very fortunate that we had scientists on our staff that were world authorities on ferns. We had meetings every month of the New York chapter of the American Fern Society. And so immediately I got engrossed in them and then, of course, fell in love with them even more.
Well, you know, we see ferns in every dinosaur movie.
Exactly.
Give us a little of the history of ferns. When do we think they first appeared on Earth?
Well, the first land plants really came on about 450 million years ago or so. You know, it's quite a long time ago. Well, first plants, let's say that, not land plants so much. And then the ferns were the first to become what we call vascular, making a specialized tissue that allowed them to kind of move out of the water and onto the land. And so they precede all of our seed-producing plants, because they came on the scene probably about 350 million years ago. And they were probably from the ancient ferns that don't make seed but make spore. They're, we know from the fossil records that there are some plants we call seed ferns that were probably that transition, that we don't have any of those alive today, but probably were the transition to our modern-day seed plants. So they've been around for a really, really long time, colonizing great parts of the planet and giving us our coal deposits that we've been using and using and using from buried giant forests of the ancient ferns, the lycophytes, that were 100 or 150 feet tall and that got buried during, you know, continents colliding and all kinds of massive changes on our planet. And those deep buried reserves are what we use now as coal.
Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, they're unique, I think, in the plant world because, as you were talking about, they produce not by flowers or seeds but via spores.
Yes, so the first plants were the algae in the water, and then the what we call the mosses, which most people have heard of, and things like liverworts, which maybe people haven't heard of. These were just very low, flat, filmy plants that kind of hugged the water surface. They kind of moved out of water, but they had to be in contact with water all the time, basically. And it was really from them, they reproduced by spore. From then, we kind of got the ferns, who also reproduced by spore. But what they did, which was an enormous change, which hasn't really been changed since then, is they developed what we call a vascular system. It's like not the same, obviously, as what we have in humans or animals, a vein and artery system, a system that conducts water and nutrients and the sugars that it makes in photosynthesis through the plant body. So it's like our blood moving through our body. It's their stuff moving through their bodies to keep them alive. And that's what enabled them to get away from the water, to be able to put roots down into the soil and take water out and to be able to get taller and bigger and stronger. And that system, that vascular system, is really important. And we don't have anything more advanced than that today. So they have one step in the what we call the ancient world, their ancestral world, reproducing by spore. And they have the one foot in the modern world, the evolved world, with their vascular system. So they are unique in having that. It's a very distinct difference.
And they were used, they were used differently, or they've been used by humans over the years in different ways, I guess. How did humans use ferns in the past?
Well, they've always been used as ornaments. Many of them are just really attractive, and something in them calls to us because it's very typical that when people see certain types of ferns, particularly things like the maidenhairs, people are drawn to them. People are drawn to plants. We know this, and research has proven this now. We are naturally drawn to nature and to plants, and our blood pressure goes down when we get into the forest mm-hmm. and things like this. So we know we respond to this. But ferns have a lot of them, with their textures and their forms, have just really drawn people to them. And in the mid-1800s, which is not so long ago, we had, well, in Europe, they had the Victorian fern craze. And what really led to that was the fact that Dr. Ward had invented the Wardian case. He was an amateur science person, and he was collecting ferns. And in Europe, with the burning of coal, there was so much pollution and the air was dry that he developed this little case, and he kept his plants alive in that. And so it's called the Wardian case after him. And that made a great change for people to be able to grow things they couldn't grow indoors. And it was a big craze. And they went all over England, particularly, unfortunately, collecting so much that they really overcollected and endangered many plants. It was such a craze. But we're able to keep them alive in their parlors, in their homes, and it was exciting to show people what they had. And the forms, you can also see how beautiful the forms of ferns are, because you see them in benches, you see them in signs, you see them in pictures. Every time you look at a catalog, even for furniture, you'll see a picture of a couch in a living room setting, and what's on the wall is a print of a fern leaf. So you see them everywhere because they do have great forms, and they're attractive to us as plants are, but ferns seem to be a little more so. And so you see them everywhere. So people have been using them. We don't eat too much of them, but we do eat fiddleheads. And depending on where you are in the world, people eat different species. Probably you have it in Wisconsin as well, but certainly in the Northeast here, the one we usually eat are the fiddlehead ferns, the ostrich ferns, the fiddleheads of the ostrich fern, one of our natives. And so we eat those, but they're also eaten in other parts of the world. There is one, though, that has been eaten, and we do know that it probably is somewhat carcinogenic, and so we wouldn't recommend that one. That's bracken fern, which is really a joke in the fern world that we say there's only one bracken plant in the world, and it's connected across the entire world. It is a massive plant that just spreads, and that's why we joke it spreads so much. We think it's just one continuous plant. So it's a great plant, but we think that we know that that one you probably shouldn't eat so much of.
Penny in Winona, Minnesota has a comment or a question. Let's go there. Penny,
sure.
Hi.
Sure.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I probably missed it when I was talking to the person who answered, but I had the ferns at my house in New Jersey. So hello, Doctor, from my native New Yorker. And I just have a question, because the ones that you can eat, are they the ostrich ferns that you can eat, the little
fiddleheads?
Yes, the fiddleheads. Thank you. It was blanking.
Yeah.
I had those growing in my garden in New Jersey, and they became very invasive. I loved them, but
yes,
they really went crazy. Now, I was interested in putting them by where I had some evergreens on the border of my property here in Minnesota, And is that, do you know if that's something that I should have a problem with being like invasive to Minnesota? They do have room where I want to put them to kind of go free.
Right. So we wouldn't technically call it invasive because it would be native for you. And just so you know, if a plant is very aggressive, but it's native, then it's naturally evolved in that habitat, and we don't call it invasive. But yes, as you have learned from experience, it does spread. And in areas where you want that great covering, that's fantastic. If you have a very limited space, you will kind of always be pulling it out. I have grown it in containers in spaces where I didn't want it to colonize. So it would probably act much the same for you as it did in New Jersey. And so that's really for you to choose. But if you pull it up every year, like if every year you do a little, you would maintain it. If you let it get out of control, that's when it's going to start taking hold, and that will be a bigger job for you to dig out.
Yeah.
I hope that helps.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Penny, thanks a lot for calling. Our guest, Moby Weinstein, her book is The Complete Book of Ferns. That's one of her books, anyway. It's a dandy book on ferns, and it's fun talking with her about them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here visiting with Moby Weinstein, foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden. And her book is that I've had a chance to look at and really love. It's called titled The Complete Book of Ferns. You know, when I think about ferns, sort of like a Boston fern comes to mind. The lace of the leaves, and really quite beautiful. But ferns, I mean, you look at a tongue fern, for example. Now that doesn't look like a fern.
Exactly. It's something that people do. When I ask people what makes a plant a fern, of course, most people don't know, but they think, oh, it has very lacy, delicate leaves. Yeah. And many of them do, but many of them do not. And you would look at that plant and not guess at all that it's a fern, unless you started to know something about, oh, they make spores, and you happen to look and you might recognize that it's making spores on the back of the leaf. But they are so really diverse. There's about 12,000 species, really worldwide, except for Antarctica, where apparently in the fossil record it shows they were there at one point, but not now. And so some are very large, very coarse, and some are very fine. And there's shades of light green to dark green and even bluish or, you know, like a grayish color. And then you have the painted fern, which is a very common one for outdoors, which has silver and often red in it. So they're really quite diverse, and people don't always recognize one if it's not a more common one that they've seen.
Yeah, and you know, you take one like the ribbon fern, for example, where you've got sort of a green edge along the outside of the leaf, and then a sort of a very, very light green center to it.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
And white and silver, yeah. And their forms, between their forms and their colors and even their textures, they can be a very thick leathery texture, which often tells you they might do better without some humidity, because the ones that are very thin and delicate usually need more humidity. But they do give great, you know, not only their form, but their texture and their colors. And if you can mix, and there's plenty for indoors that, if you're an indoor grower, those, or if you're in a tropical climate, you can do them outdoors. But you guys are not tropical, as we are not in New York.
That's for sure. Oh, boy. Well, you know, you think about ferns in humid settings.
Right.
Do we need to create that indoors?
Well, here we go again. This is where most of our homes do not have good humidity. And so, number one, it's better for us if the humidity is higher, especially in wintertime. It's better for our health as well as the plants. But if you can't humidify, there are some ferns that are really well adapted. And the one you named, the ribbon fern, is one of the terrace ferns. Those are generally pretty good for growing indoors. They don't need a lot of attention. And some of the bird's nest ferns, and one of the, we don't necessarily call it the Boston fern, but it's a very close relative. We call it the sword fern, and it basically looks the same, but it's a different species. And that is really tough for indoors. So I have an apartment in New York City, and I live with the same problems that a lot of indoor people have, high heat and dry air. And so these are ones that they do not get babied. They survive. They're good growers. The maidenhairs are the opposite. They tend to have very delicate leaves, and if they don't have enough humidity, they will just fry on you. And a point to make about humidity that I find a lot of people maybe don't understand, or just out of desperation might try, watering the soil doesn't make up for humidity in the air. So if your air is so dry, you can't keep watering the plant to make up for it. You wind up just rotting it. So grouping your plants together helps. Of course, having a humidifier will help greatly. And also, if you're trying to increase the humidity, put them on little trays or saucers where you have water in the tray so it can evaporate and cool and humidify the air. Just make sure the base of the pot or container is not sitting in the water. Usually you put pebbles or marbles or something like that to keep it above the water so it doesn't keep the soil wet, but it keeps the air more humid. You'd be amazed how quickly that evaporates. You could be filling it every day, and that's how you realize, wow, the air is really dry.
Bev in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bev.
Sure. I'm wondering if you are familiar with the black rabbit's foot fern.
Uh-huh.
I have one. It's beautiful, easy to take care of, but it has a very unusual, I guess it's a root, it gets all fuzzy and grows all over the place underneath, around the pot.
Right. So that's not actually the root. Everyone thinks it is because it's not typical for us to see that. It's actually the stem that you see. And the stem is covered in those are Dahlias. And that group is kind of known for having these long creeping rhizomes, we call them. It's a modified stem. And they're covered with hairs, which is why often they look like a rabbit's foot, and some have a whiter scales and hairs. They're really more scales, and some have more brown, and some have almost more black, and they can be slender or very thick. It all depends on the species. But they normally don't grow in the soil. They like to grow on rocks or on other trees or plants, and then they have just small root systems that kind of cling onto those things. But it makes them very attractive for us. If you're ever repotting it and they're growing outside, that means they're happy. Don't take them and stick them into the soil because that will rot them because they're used to being out in the air. And luckily, they're pretty tolerant of drier conditions. So they make a good houseplant for us. But they also have a very handsome leaf. But their little creeping stems like that are very curious. And it people are like, this is fun. What's this? And then they, and then you can pet them. You don't have a cat or a dog to pet.
Oh, Bev, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, Mary emailed back to the ostrich ferns for a minute. She said, yes, ostrich ferns take over in central Wisconsin, just like in New York. She says she's speaking from experience.
Yes, and I know that feeling.
Oh, man. You know, probably the most, perhaps the strangest fern that I noted in your book was the squirrel's foot fern, which I would never guess was a fern.
It does look
almost like a squirrel's tail to me, but tell us about the squirrel's foot fern.
Yeah, that's also one of the Dahlias, right? So that picture in the book that you can see, other people probably can't, is exactly what Bev, I think I got her name right, was just asking about, her Dahlia, her rabbit's foot. So they're called rabbit's foot, squirrel's foot, it depends on it. But it's really the stem, and they're just covered with these scales. And that helps to protect them a little because they are sitting out there exposed. But what they'll do if you grow them in a basket, if it's a plastic basket, they don't really adhere to it. But if it's clay and it's porous, they'll often kind of stick to it a little, and especially if it's a moss basket, then they will definitely grow around the outside, and you will see all of that kind of fuzzy stem around the bottom and then the green leaves on top. But it's not something you want to camouflage. It's actually something you want to see. It's part of the interesting part of the plant.
Oh, definitely, definitely is. So what are the varieties you most recommend for growing inside?
For inside, I would recommend the bird's nest fern, particularly the Japanese one, which is botanically Asplenium antiquum. I find that to be, and not just myself, but if you read about it, probably other people will say as well, that one of the species is probably the easiest indoors, and it's a little smaller, although keeping it in small pots will prevent it from getting 2 feet long each leaf. I have them, as I said, in small pots in my apartment, and they're not bigger than, you know, 12 inches across the entire plant. That's because it's in a small pot. If I keep potting it up and potting up, I could get it to be 2 to 4 feet across, but that would be too big for me. But in our greenhouses, you know, at the Botanical Garden, we do have them that large, but they stay a little smaller, but they just tolerate indoors beautifully. And there are some very cool varieties of it. They tend to, what we say, fork at the tips, so they get crested and their tips get all funny looking and people love them, or the edges get ruffled. So there are also some nice varieties of those. The brake ferns or the terrace ferns are also give us some good coloring, as you were mentioning, and are easy. The Dahlias, the squirrel's foot, rabbit's foot, hare's foot, those are great. The Japanese holly fern is a good indoor fern as well. Might be hardy for some people depending on where they live, but not for your climate and our climate. Those are some of my favorites of them. And also the sword fern that I mentioned, the Nephrolepis cordifolia, is a wonderful one for indoors.
That's a really cool plant. I like those leaves.
Yeah.
Well, your book, here we're running out of time, but I did want to mention the back part of your book where you have talking about terrariums and creating them and pressed fern art are just absolutely fabulous. And
thank you.
The artwork is great, and I love the cover, the complete book of ferns. And Moby, it's been a pleasure. Would you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
I would love to. Absolutely. Anytime.
Moby Weinstein.
It's nice to speak to other people.
And we'll have more people for you to talk with next time around. Moby Weinstein.
Great.
She is the
thank
foreman
so
of, yes, thank you for being with us. She's the foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. And her book is one of the two books, but the book I have in front of me is The Complete Book of Ferns. Fantastic book. Well, we have a fantastic group of people to work on this program. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. We've got technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins with me today. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. Thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.